Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 255. This week on the podcast, we have no rundown because of Politicon, but we'll have coverage of that and more.
This is Brain Trust Live. Hey guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com.
That's right.
This weekend, you could find us at Politicon.
Holy moly.
And we are tired.
We're tired.
Let me tell you.
Yeah.
We have done 2 days straight of nothing but going to political panels and generally listening to a bunch of shit-starting nonsense and people we love.
Right.
Talking about everything.
Yes.
So we'll tell you a little bit about that, but we're also going to go through the main stories of the week without notes.
Right.
So forgive us if
this
we
is be a real
screw
experiment.
Up our facts.
It's an experimental podcast.
We're like at our maximum amount of tiredness.
Yeah, don't
and
fact check us. We're not interested.
We're not interested in that right now.
Right.
But we didn't want to leave you high and dry because this was an exciting week news.
And so much of the news, at least as far as I'm concerned, was like, besides the healthcare vote, which we'll start with after we talk about Politicon, but like, so much of it was just sort of like the type of news that I live for.
It had a couple
crazy speeches. It had petty gossip. It had the things that like
we come by
and we enjoy. Yeah. So
exactly.
Like we couldn't not talk about it.
Exactly.
So, but Politicon definitely had like gossip because like that's what Politicon is. It's
Politicon
gossip.
Is literally it's Politico in person.
Right. Exactly.
It's just like a hill rag in your face.
Totally. Yeah. And like it was great. There were so many fun moments. There always are. I feel like the big takeaway this year, like besides the actual panels that we saw, which we'll talk about, but like emboldened Trump supporters everywhere in an upsetting fashion.
Much more conservative crowd this year than usual.
For sure.
Again, I mean, part of the reason we go there is to be able to see conservative figures and pundits speak
in the wild
because, you know, normally we're not found at Ann Coulter speaking engagements.
No, we're not.
But it is worth hearing what everyone has to say just so that you know what their arguments are and how their audience is responding to those arguments.
Yeah.
And you got a chance to hear that. My favorite thing is that Allison Lundgren Grimes asked us if we thought there were more Trump supporters than usual at Politicon this year.
We had a lovely conversation
with her. The Kentucky Attorney General who ran against Mitch McConnell.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
We had a lovely conversation with her. She was very nice.
She was very nice.
Charming.
Posted a picture for proof
exactly.
that it happened.
But she was like, does it feel like a different crowd this year than usual?
We were like,
it does.
Also, my favorite moment was when Jacob Soboroff said to us, good to see you guys again.
He remembered us,
you guys.
He recognized us. We took a picture with him on Saturday.
Uh-huh.
And then on Sunday, we asked him if another friend of ours who hadn't been there on Saturday could take a picture with him. And
he was like, oh, it's you guys.
Yes.
Yeah.
We're famous, is all I can come up with.
Yeah,
I mean,
basically.
That's the only answer here,
and from,
I think.
Like, I want to be recognized by Jacob Soboroff more than pretty much anybody there.
I can see why.
Yeah. He's as adorable in person as one might expect.
I mean, he did not disappoint in person.
He really didn't.
But hopefully, we spoke to a lot of great activists there. We saw a lot of great people, and we're hoping to get some people on the podcast in the coming months. So stay tuned for that. Specifically, we were speaking to Lady Parts Justice. We spoke to Black Lives Matter.
Yep.
We're hoping that we can get someone from either the national or the LA chapter of Black Lives Matter on the podcast soon. We're hoping that we can get Liz Winstead on the podcast.
Yeah. The other thing that's cool about you know, they have this area called the Democracy Village, and like it's where they have like all the booths
like
or
the
whatever.
Tables.
And we also talked to a lot of people, one of whom we actually interviewed, which we'll post because we're going to do sort of like a best of like Politicon, you know, audio
mashup
for you that's going to come at some point this week. But we talked to a lot of those guys, and we're going to try and have them on the podcast too. New innovative ways to like get people either via social media or whatever, sort of like interacting with each other, interacting directly with their politics or politicians, being able to find out what elections are happening, being able to give to like specific candidates or to specific causes. And like there was a lot of that going around there, which is really cool. And so that's something that like we definitely, you know, obviously enjoy talking about. So we're gonna try and have some of those guys on as well.
Specifically, we were talking to there's a new kind of mobile website that's not an app, but it's a mobile site that is focused on down ticket races and helping you stay involved in down ticket races. We were excited about that. So that should be really cool. As far as panels go, we went to the Chelsea Handler Tommy Lauren panel. We went to the Simone Sanders, Tommy Lauren panel.
That was the best one.
We went,
I think,
to
personally.
Various Ann Coulter panels because she's on every fucking panel. And we went to a wild women's panel.
Wild in that, but wild
had
and
an
also
Ann Coulter
some,
light. On
yeah,
them.
I was gonna say, like, wild and yet somehow boring.
Yeah, somehow it managed to be both.
Yeah, thank God that Grace was there because she was like,
yes,
funny and like
exactly.
But like Anna Navarro was on that panel and we were really looking forward to seeing her, and she like had like a few lines when she first introduced herself at the very beginning. She was like,
"I'm that woman who said
I'm
pussy
Anna Navarro and I said pussy on
television,"
and I was like, "This panel's gonna be great," and then sort of like devolved from there. And you could there was a look on her face. I think we tweeted about this, but yeah. Like she looked like she sort of like regretted her. All of her life choices
she
that had led to that moment, like being on this channel,
out.
Basically.
At really a certain point.
Out.
And she
yeah.
had to.
Yeah.
Yeah. Our friend Grace Parra was on that panel, and she was trying to kind of, she was making some good points, and she was also the only one making
funny.
Any jokes.
Yeah.
And they were all jokes that were also like relevant.
Yeah.
But it was, and Liz Winstead was on that panel and was just like furious
well, she
was because there was,
rage,
the, panel,
right, there was a
troll
on the
panel, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was some one of the LA Women's March organizers who just seemed like she was not used to this kind of pundit clashing.
Yeah.
And so she was sort of like.
She wasn't great.
She
and
was
then,
in
like,
over her head in terms of the public argument.
And Amy Holmes
sphere.
Was moderating
was a
it. And I don't,
moderator.
I don't dislike her,
no,
but like
but
she
was
like
not
wasn't a great moderator. Like they opened it up for questions and the questions were like bonkers, like crazy town. Like,
yeah.
And like people
well,
just
they
like,
were
went
just
off
speeches
on their, like, their
of
own,
self-promotion.
Right. Yeah,
they weren't
yeah,
questions.
Exactly. So wasn't great, but like that was, but the. Simone Sanders, like,
oh
literally jumping out of her chair and, like, screaming at Tommy Lauren.
That was such a great conversation.
Like, Simone Sanders should win a
like,
world
some
award sort
of
like, peace award
yeah.
for, like, for not actually, like, murdering Tommy Lauren yeah. on stage. Like, she...
Well,
she
and
really...
what was interesting is we had seen the hyped Chelsea Handler Tommy Lauren panel, and
yes.
we did. We were there for the moment that Tommy Lauren admitted that she is on her parents' health insurance
yeah.
because of Obamacare.
Yes,
we were there when she admitted that Obamacare has benefited her, and then when she tried to say, "Well, some of the things are good, like being able to stay on your parents' health plan until you're
right.
26,"
like,
and
oh,
we
right.
realized that she's a 24-year-old who has never purchased health insurance in the private market, so
no.
everything that she says about health
right.
insurance is based on nothing.
Right. Well, she talked. You know, ad nauseum about the, you know, free market.
Yeah.
Which she's,
and
never,
she's
had
never
to experience.
No. And right. we have, and it sucked.
It's terrible. It's the worst.
But so, but Chelsea Handler is a comedian, and she did a lot of research for that panel, and you could tell she tried to come armed
right.
with facts, but
she
is not a politician,
right.
and she was not always able to provide the counterpoint that, you know, a person who's sort of versed in this kind of political discussion
yeah, a person
discussion
like Simone
can.
Sanders.
Simone Sanders is a communications professional for a reason, you guys.
Like her,
she came ready.
Her ability to, like, tolerate Tommy Lauren devolved quickly.
Yes, like, but her ability to be articulate about how to answer to Tommy Lauren's more
did.
Hypocritical facts never did. She
yeah.
stayed on top of her shit.
Yeah.
And it was... glorious
it was,
to watch.
Totally was. Yeah, it yeah. really. Well, she always is.
I mean,
so,
she's
I mean,
been.
Like,
she was great
she's
on
a,
every
she's
panel
a real
we
dream.
Saw her on.
Yeah.
yeah. I if usually we come out of Politicon and there's one conservative figure that we're like fascinated by.
Yeah.
This year, I didn't find a conservative figure that
Me
I cared
either.
Much for, but I am like a crazy Simone Sanders devotee now.
For sure.
Like she's like I'm. She's now like our queen. Like
yeah.
And
for sure.
and that is. The first year that we've walked out with that kind of feeling about someone from our own camp.
Right. Yeah. Usually.
Normally
usually,
we know the people from our
I
own
I was
going to
say, usually the thoughts that we have about our own camp is like some sort of like new incarnation of hatred for James Carville or Paul Begala.
Yes. like, and I remain not sorry that I call Paul Begala my arch nemesis
right.
on a regular basis and
yeah.
the arch nemesis of this podcast. Because as much as he's like someone who... In the Michelle Bachmann mold, I was saying this to Brent last night because we saw him on a couple panels yesterday. In
yeah.
the Michelle Bachmann mold is trying to have the right thoughts at this point
right.
and is failing.
Yeah,
he
because
is
I
unable
actually,
to process his own thoughts in a helpful way.
Yeah, if I went away with anything in regards to Paul Begala, it was actually sort of like liking him a little bit better, but not in the sense that I'm like now all of a sudden a Paul Begala fan because he's not all the way there yet, but he is at least sort of
trying
like,
to reflect
right,
a little.
His brain is like, starting like the rewiring process, but it's very early
yet.
In the game.
Well, like, and what I found with him, what I've never noticed with him, but what I finally realized is he has a weird authoritarian streak where he's looking for a figure who is a savior.
Yes.
And he will defend that savior till the end, even though we know that the Clinton administration made mistakes. And I think at this point it's okay to admit that even if you were in that administration, that you now see that some things, even if you went in with good intentions, you can now say, you know, some of our policy that we had good intentions with didn't work out the way we wanted, if that's how you want to phrase it, whatever. But he is unable to kind of differentiate his own thoughts from those of the savior. And he is just out there looking for a new savior. He is not, because every time that we heard a Democrats panel that he was on that was about the future of the party, there were a lot of those.
Yeah, it's like, we need to find this one character that's going to be able to carry the hopes and dreams of both the left and the middle and the right. Yeah, exactly.
We need to find the person who can talk to the, you know, working class white voter and whatever.
There's probably an election tomorrow.
Exactly. And he was never like able to say, okay, here's what our message should be, and we can try to get a lot of people on board with that message. It was always like, we need to find the guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, and also we took away that he is literally in love with Hillary Clinton.
He
referenced his love for Hillary Clinton.
He said, I don't like her. I don't respect her. I don't support her.
I literally love her.
Yeah, exactly. Like in a sort of like, and I got what he meant because he's known the Clintons for a really long time.
Sure.
But like,
I also felt creeped out.
I was going to say, he said it multiple times to the point where it was like, all right, dude, we get it. You love Hillary Clinton.
Right,
like, I mean, like, this, you're on a panel with people, like, recording, like, you know?
It was like so
it felt very
being weird.
It felt weird. Yes.
Stop being weird.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was, I think, one of the, it was a much bigger event than it had been in past years. It was a much more sort of, I won't say balanced event, but there was certainly a lot more conservative presence there than usual.
Tommy Lauren, Ann Coulter were both there. And like last year, Ann Coulter
those kind of people.
But like Ben Shapiro was there.
Is a little bit more left-leaning. Usually it's just kind of like pundits and then Michael Steele.
Right.
And this year they had a lot more interest in the conservative panelists who were holding their own panels. I mean, Ben Shapiro had his own panel.
Yep.
And it wasn't in the mold of like Sarah Palin's speech.
Right.
It was in the mold of Ben Shapiro getting to lecture to his followers.
Right.
And that was different.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because so many people tried to get into that Ben Shapiro panel that they couldn't. And then they started filtering into other panels and just like disrupting shit.
Right. Exactly.
There were also there's a few things that we noticed in terms of wardrobe. One of which was that there were a lot of Make America Great Again hats. That was concerning.
And
a lot of people in suits with Make America Great Again hats.
And let us leave you with a, well, not leave you. We're not going anywhere.
Right.
At least immediately
right
now.
Yeah, don't worry about that.
But I mean, in regards to, you will never be able to look at a Make America Great Again hat in the same way after hearing what I'm about to tell you, which we heard at the Black Lives Matter panel, where it was said that the red hats are the new white sheets. And like
all of a sudden,
everybody in the audience literally gasped. And then like a good solid half of everyone gave like a standing ovation. Yeah. And like you like the rest of the day walking around every time I saw
like,
one of those,
the
I was
Klan
like,
is here.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
It was
which
scary.
Is like,
which is true.
Which
I mean,
it's scary. I mean, and it's true. Scary because it's true.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, as much as I bet members of the Klan often try to claim that they're not there for the racism.
Right. Of course
you know?
They do. Yeah,
they're there
sure.
to protect their culture. They're there for whatever.
Yeah,
I bet that they often claim that
even
they're
Ann
not.
Even Ann Coulter was talking about like, you know, how like this country was built on like Anglo-Saxon. She kept
Ann
Coulter said the
values.
Word Anglo-Saxon like at least a thousand times yesterday. Yeah. More than Tommy Lauren said Venezuela, which is impressive because
hard.
She said Venezuela at least 50 times.
That woman mentions Venezuela at least 3 times per conversation, even if what you're talking about is like puppies in the Sudan.
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, she will find a way to bring Venezuela into any conversation.
Really, a woman who
and
just
anytime,
does not like what's going on in Venezuela. And
anytime
does,
that you mention Benghazi, she's like, well, what about Venezuela? As if those are related facts. Like, it was like anytime you mentioned a thing, emails, Benghazi, any of her usual dog whistles, she would be like, well, how come no one's, Russia was the one that she really got going with, where she would be like, well, no one's talking about Venezuela.
Yeah.
It would be like, well, Venezuela didn't collude to, you know, to right. win the U.S. election. Like, I don't, it's upsetting what's going on in Venezuela.
Of course.
It's not on the same level of sort of domestic interest for a reason, though.
Right.
She wasn't aware of why. In any case, we're going to do kind of like a supercut of all.
Yeah.
Of our time at Politicon. So stay tuned for that. We'll be releasing that at some point this week. But for now, we are going to move on to the big stories of the week. The first being the...
You have healthcare.
Failed healthcare choice. You guys, what a roller coaster.
CNN has never been more exciting.
Oh my God. And by the way, more boring and more exciting at the same time.
Well,
because
I know. Because it was also Don Lemon, which was upsetting. But I mean,
worst. So all week, they had been failing to pass incarnations of the healthcare vote. Yeah. And finally, they were going to do the skinny repeal,
yeah, the skinny,
which was a fake repeal where they were going to send a pseudo repeal to the House so that they could go into conference and come up with a bill that they could all agree on.
Like, and the irony seemed to totally be lost on them, because what they were like, I'm sure you know what the skinny repeal is at this point, but like what you sort of like may not have like fully wrapped your head around, or maybe you have, I don't know, but like what, like I was having this moment on Thursday, which was when they were going to be like voting on it, where I was like, what they are asking to do is like literally the most insane thing that like you get, and disingenuous, because like they were wanting to pass something only
if they knew it wouldn't become law.
If they knew it would never become law.
They extracted promises from Senate leadership that the bill that they were voting on would not become law.
And from House leadership that they wouldn't vote on it. Because like they knew the law was so bad that there was a danger that the House would just up and vote on it and send it to the president and then it would pass. So like they literally made Paul Ryan release a statement that like he wasn't going to vote on it. And that like, I mean like, so insane that like you are begging and pleading with your conference to vote on something that is so shitty you never want it to actually like become law.
And also they released it and then voted on it like 2 hours later in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
But very dramatic moment. So
for sure.
It seemed like, I'm not really sure how the whipping happened for the skinny repeal, because they had been voting on so many versions of the law. The reason they were able to open the votes is because John McCain literally came back from recovering from brain surgery.
Gave some great, wonderful diagnosed speech about very how to return things cancer. To order and like and how then, this is not things should be oper- how things should be operating.
And then voted to proceed.
And then like voted to proceed, which was
Everyone was like, that was like a collective gasp of all of America.
Right. We're like, really? This douche just like had some healthcare on some brain cancer and then is and coming just, back, like, to, back to like rob ensure all of that us like of our healthcare? Right exactly which and is then, ultimately how it went down exactly. But like it but was certainly a turn of events
and so then all week we're getting news that variations on this bill are failing. The House bill failed, the Senate bill failed,
right? A full repeal they voted on in 2015 failed.
They couldn't get anything
we
passed.
Kept getting new like random CBO scores for like different
right and
things,
suddenly it was like 32 was million people 19 million it was like a different numbers of people were going to lose their insurance, but it was always almost it was always over 20 basically.
It was,
I think a regular repeal was going to be 19 or something. I mean, it was a nightmare.
Right.
In any case, the skinny repeal is their last great white hope.
Right, exactly.
And it's and they're frantically whipping votes for it all week because they know that it could come down to the wire. And there are groups of Republicans meeting in secret trying to figure out what to do about this because they know it cannot become law.
And they're writing it over their lunch hour.
Yeah,
truly,
exactly.
On Thursday.
Truly writing it over their lunch hour. The word skinny repeal was invented earlier in the week. The bill itself was not.
Yeah, right.
And by the way, there's no such thing as a skinny repeal of anything.
No.
You can either repeal it and then, you know, hope that nothing bad happens, or you cannot repeal
it. And like once the insurance companies figured out what this thing is too, like, but the other thing that's so disingenuous about this is because the insurance companies came out and said that like this was going to like bring total like volatility to the market, because basically what they were going to do is they were going to remove like a lot of the, you know, they were going to remove the individual mandate, which is the, you know, the cost.
The only reason anyone for, is buying insurance,
exactly.
Which
so,
is
like,
keeping the prices
down.
So
they were like, this is going to just be like to make the market totally, you know, volatile.
Yeah, it's
and
chaos.
Like, and the whole thing that the Republicans have been saying that they want, the reason that they want to pass something in the first place is so they can bring stability to the market.
Yeah.
So it's like the whole idea that they were going to like,
yeah, it was disingenuous.
They were like, actually, they were like, you know, full stop lying about like what this bill was going to do.
Yeah.
It was going to do the opposite, the exact opposite thing of the reason that they claimed that they were going to be like voting on this in the first place.
In any case, it's 1:30 in the morning on the East Coast. Here, it's not.
Yeah.
Brent texts me as I'm driving home and is like, it's happening now.
Right.
I rush home. I turn on
turn
CNN.
On the television.
And as usual, the Senate is the most boring voting body in history.
Yeah.
So I'm watching these votes come in. I watch Collins vote no, not surprised. I watch Murkowski vote no, not surprised.
Yeah.
The thing that I almost don't catch because it's so subtle.
When you can't hear him. You can hear a lot of people actually answering.
And you don't hear when McCain is called, but he puts his thumb down.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, nothing is said on CNN, but Twitter, like, loses fucking
its
mind. And
you hear some applause and some gasping,
right,
like, in the chamber.
I mean, this, by the way, there's huge protests going on outside. There's protests happening inside the chamber. Like, there's chaos happening around every turn.
Yeah.
And so this is not happening in the with the secrecy that they were hoping it would happen.
Well, and I was I think people were rightly concerned about this vote because we knew it was being brought to a vote and we knew it was their last ditch effort. And in my brain, and we were talking about this at lunch today, I'm thinking to myself, I'm so shocked that they're even going to vote on this because they obviously don't have the votes because there's Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, and Dean Heller.
I know.
Because Dean Heller had a goddamn press conference with the governor of his state talking about how he was going to make sure that everybody was protected in his state and, like, he wasn't, you know, he didn't get, you know, like, I haven't gone to the Senate to, like, you know, remove people's health care from them. And, like, you know, he's a person who
he's
is, like,
he's been riding this resistance to this bill.
He's from a blue state. He's up for re-election in 2018. Like, he has been sort of, like, as outspoken about the thing as really up until that point as Collins and Murkowski had been, really.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, why are they voting on this? And then I'm like, well, if they are actually going to vote on this, like,
they must
I'm
have
fucking
the votes.
Scared because, like, don't they have the votes?
And it appeared that they thought they had the votes. The
I
McCain
think they
thing
they
came
had
as a surprise, it looked like, to McConnell
because,
as well.
Right, because there have now been reports, actually, that Pence, who was there thinking that he was going to have to be the 51st vote, apparently talked to McCain for, like, almost 20 minutes before the vote.
Yeah.
And supposedly there are also people were saying that Trump called him, that he took on the Senate floor. And I was I was like, dude, like, that's probably what
it would
like,
be more,
pushed him, that's what pushed him over the edge.
It would
man.
Be more effective to literally have Hillary Clinton call him.
I know.
Like,
right?
It would be more effective to have almost any single person on the Hill call him,
like,
except
send,
Donald Trump.
To send your friend Lindsey over to talk
well,
to you. You know,
I
like,
have a theory,
yes.
which is that a private pact was made because there are all these secret meetings going on the Hill, including resistance meetings among the Republicans.
Right.
I have a theory that earlier in the day, a quiet decision was made for John McCain to be the one who goes down for everyone else. They all needed to get their yes vote on the record.
On the record,
I get
for
that,
their bases.
For their bases.
Right.
Lindsey
John
Graham
McCain
can't
is about to, bless his heart, die.
Right.
Like have him do it. He's probably not going to run
he's
for re-election.
He's not going to run again.
Right.
He doesn't need the money. Like, the and also, he's got
and
such
he loves
a
this. He loves this anyway.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Like,
well,
this is his
he looks
his
like
brand.
A maverick.
This is his brand.
His brand
right.
is being a maverick. And and also, he is one of the last remaining senators who really does sometimes work across the aisle and has friends across the aisle. And so this has been, I think, probably more disruptive to his business as usual than anything else. And so I think a quiet decision was made for him to take the hit for all of them, because there were a number of people in there who, if this bill had actually happened and anything had kind of moved forward from there, would have lost their fucking jobs.
Yeah, exactly.
With all the money in the world.
The other, my favorite, because they were of course at Politicon talking about healthcare a lot, and it was, I believe it was Jon Favreau who was talking about, like, meeting all of the McCain people in 2008 because he was working for Obama.
Oh yes.
And he said he had that
quote during Pod Save America.
Yeah, and he said that one thing that always stuck with him was that the McCain people said that the reason that they loved him so much was because he was 9-part hero and 1-part troll.
Yes.
And like, and this is that. I would say it might have been closer to maybe more than 1-part troll in this respect. But like, I think like at least part of this was like, had Donald Trump truly never said what he said about John McCain, I think that we would all be panicked about our healthcare right now.
I agree. I think that there is a part of John McCain that doesn't let that shit go. You gotta, to survive the number of plane crashes.
The man was in a POW camp for 7 fucking years.
Exactly.
Like,
he's tough.
Screw you, Donald Trump.
Exactly.
Like, and this is that. This allowed him to, like, go out on that.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah, no, I think John McCain got, you know, looked like a hero, got all the credit, because no one gives women credit.
And he also gets
Murkowski
to really
Collins,
sleep well at night,
exactly.
too, now. You know what I mean?
Like, Murkowski and Collins were, by the way, the two most consistent and steadfast opponents
to this policy. And people are giving
policy.
That,
and
you know,
finally, I think we're talking about
that now. Like, obviously, you know what? It was newsier that John McCain voted no, like, because that was a surprise. So, like, I get that, like, at least early Friday morning when everybody woke up,
the
headlines were John McCain saved everybody's healthcare. But, like, now that we've sort of, like, had some time to, like, sit and reflect, it's sort of, like, I think everyone, you know, all of the people except the 17% of people who liked the Republicans' healthcare plan, you know, are, like, now really realizing that it's actually, like, time to thank Collins and Murkowski, who have been steadfast on
from
the beginning. And Susan Collins in 2015, when there was no chance of a repeal actually passing because President Obama was still the president.
Right, she still voted against it, right?
She still voted against it. So, like, you know, I know that there are some people who sort of, like, mad at those two, but, like, you know, maybe get mad at Lisa Murkowski, but, like, certainly don't get mad, but don't, because, I mean, Susan Collins is, she's been on the front lines of not wanting to repeal Obamacare
for a while. Also, this is a Republican problem. Murkowski is the Bernie Sanders of the Republican Party. She was primaried out of her election.
Yeah, people had to learn how to
spell Murkowski. She won a write-in candidacy in Alaska,
Where
I can imagine the name Murkowski isn't that common.
probably not.
Well, I know they can see Russia from their houses or whatever.
That's
but,
true. Yeah.
But I mean, this woman took on the Republican establishment, ran a write-in candidacy, and won in Alaska. Yeah. Like Bernie Sanders, she doesn't owe them shit because she can get elected without them.
No, and she doesn't like Donald Trump. She doesn't like Donald Trump. Yeah.
Exactly. And her and Collins are supporters of Planned Parenthood. The one thing, you know, they're still Republicans. I still disagree with their economic platform almost entirely.
Sure.
You know, they're still up to evil shenanigans. I'm not taking away from that. But they have been pretty steadfast supporters of women's healthcare access.
They have.
And that was something that I think, you know, in this environment, with this president, with this language being employed to talk about women's health, I think that there was no way that they could be like, yeah, no, we'll go along with this.
Oh, yeah.
We'll play ball. Like, why would they play ball
for
with
this? Yeah.
Like, don't elect. I mean, Shelley Moore Capito did.
She
remember
did.
When she was
so
going to get all that opioid money?
Yeah, but you know what? I haven't. Well, I mean,
but we knew she was going to.
As, you know, as Paul Begala reminded us, you know, Bill Clinton did better in West Virginia than he did in California.
Yeah, no,
and that was not that long ago. So perhaps we. And we saw
West
what Bernie
Virginia
Sanders.
Is a surprising state.
We saw what Bernie Sanders did. We've, you know, they had a Democratic governor for a while. They've got Joe Manchin, who's a Democratic senator. The reason I'm mentioning this is because I was about to say her job is safe, but maybe it's not. We don't know.
Listen.
But Dean Heller cooked his goose.
Yes, that was a mistake.
He is a man who in 2018 is going to be looking for a show on Fox News if they'll give it to him. Because he is...
I don't think he's interesting enough to have one.
I don't think he's interesting enough either. You know? He's a man who is basically has already lost his...
Yeah.
If only for, like, being your classic politician who basically just, like, lied about what they were going to do.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, even if you're a person who sort of, like, sometimes accidentally agrees with him. Like, I mean, he lied specifically, and he did it on television in a sort of spectacular way, and then tried to take your healthcare away from you.
Yeah, exactly.
So, like, sorry, Dean Heller, but, like, get a life.
Exactly. In any case, there's been interesting fallout from all of this that has encompassed sort of a larger White House-style drama.
Yeah.
Because Donald Trump is pissed. He's still trying to make it happen.
Yes.
It's never going away because Donald Trump cannot let go of this issue.
Yeah.
In part because he promised us that he was going to get rid of this.
Yeah, well, it's going to be easy. He was going to do it on day one.
I mean, you know, it's nothing so simple as passing a simple piece of legislation that just takes healthcare away from 32 million people.
One.
But they can't pass any legislation, so that's been more difficult than he thought.
Yeah.
Healthcare's harder than we expected, Brent.
He couldn't have
known that going in.
Well, it's also life insurance.
Exactly.
So.
Well, right. It's a complicated issue for many reasons, one of which is that it's not the kind of insurance he thinks it is.
Right.
But in any case, in the aftermath of all of this, and in part because of it, but in part because of a larger power struggle happening at the White House, Rens Priebus is out.
Rens Penis.
Gone. In the parlance of Scaramucci, who loves a juvenile nickname, apparently.
Yeah.
He's gone.
Which is rich coming from a guy whose last name is Scaramucci.
Exactly.
Like,
but now we have a general in his place. General Kelly was appointed in his place. So we might have a military coup. It's unclear what's going to happen.
Sure.
The one thing we know is that Tommy Lauren feels very comfortable with his leadership.
Yes.
And if there's one thing we know, we can trust her to know when we should and shouldn't feel comfortable with leadership. She's from a military family.
Mm-hmm.
She's from the Dakotas.
Yeah,
I can never remember which one, so I never clarify. And she's 24, so she has tons of life experience to work from.
That's right.
And obviously a student of history.
Yes.
As you can only imagine.
Yeah.
But in any case, the sort of final the final nail in the coffin of Rens Priebus was Thursday, the day that he apparently resigned,
and they kept it quiet because they didn't want to distract from, like,
the healthcare
massively
failing.
In healthcare.
And Thursday, on Thursday, we didn't know that something even more exciting was amiss.
No, we didn't.
A brew or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know the word.
Yeah, sure, whatever. A brew?
I don't think that's the word.
That's nothing.
But so in any case, one pool of White House power is now gone. And what we have in its place is a less certain political entity.
Yeah.
Someone who also has no governing experience.
Right.
Somebody who is not going to help them whip votes and do the kinds of things that a chief of staff is supposed to do because he's not really sure what that is. But the reason that he was brought in is likely because the White House is in chaos. Everyone is leaking everything that happens in the White House.
Trump has become
obsessed with leaks. That's what Scaramucci's hire was about, and that's what this General Kelly hire is about.
Right. And getting rid of Priebus.
And right.
As well. Yeah, I mean, well, like, but the Kelly,
that's
the
been
Kelly,
rumored for months.
The Kelly hire, but like also Scaramucci has basically openly claimed that he thinks that it's Priebus who has been doing the leaking, which actually really wouldn't surprise me.
Wouldn't shock me entirely.
No. Mm-mm.
I think that it's everybody that's doing the leaking, though. I think that Renz Priebus, as well as the entire White House, is leaking.
Well, and that's the thing. Like, what I think that what shocks me, and we have said this time and time again on this podcast, so we're not going to, we don't need to belabor the point, but like, what
we'll belabor a point if we want to.
But what is shocking to me that they don't seem to get is that, like, yes, some, I'm sorry, I just hit the microphone. Some of these leaks are coming from within the White House. The calls are coming from within the White House. but like, the majority of them are coming from the fucking
intelligence
FBI
community.
And the intelligence community. And like, you can fire Renz Priebus all
you can
if
fire
you
the
want.
Entire
and
White
like,
House.
And that, you know, maybe Priebus didn't have a good handle on, you know, Bannon leaking things about Kushner or vice versa.
Right.
Or maybe
there are a lot
things
of infights
like that.
Going on in
you
the
know,
White
like,
House.
There's so many, yeah, exactly. There's too many infighting things to keep track of. But like, Priebus had no control over whether somebody from the FBI leaked something about, you know, a Jared Kushner call with, you know, some Russian attorney
right.
or an in-person, like, that doesn't have anything to do with anyone other than, like, the intelligence community. And, like, bad-mouthing the intelligence community is what is causing that. It's not Renz Priebus being an idiot. Like,
no. Renz Priebus is just a sad guy with no governing experience and a ridiculous name
right.
who was A, in over his head and stupid for taking this job, right. but B, not the only, not responsible for Trump's blunders with the intelligence community.
Correct. Yes.
He was
and,
just a
and
guy.
And probably, if I had to guess, was probably trying to get him to stop.
I would, not if I had to guess. If right. I had any, if I, like I know
yeah,
it.
Right.
We he's, know this.
He's probably literally the only person who was in that White House who was doing close to what the job was that they had been hired for and was at least quasi-qualified to do
right.
it.
And that's quite a stretch.
And that's
because, again,
stretch.
We're talking about a man with no governing experience,
right.
and yet I still stand by that fact.
I know, right?
In
so,
any case,
like,
Scaramucci has a plan for getting rid of these leakers, so don't worry about it.
He does.
His plan involves calling reporters individually and demanding to know how they got their information. So this week, he decided to start at the top and called Ryan Lizza at The New Yorker and demanded to know how he found out about this dinner that Trump had with, like, Bill O'Reilly and Bill Shine, the former Fox CEO, whatchamacallit, executive.
Sure, whatever.
And basically, Ryan Lizza then wrote an article in The New Yorker that was just his conversation with Scaramucci,
right.
who
Which was
just trying to threaten him into giving up his
right.
sources.
And it was like, you know, just expletive laden. It was
oh
like
God,
him
it was
just
crazy.
Like calling him and just like wild, like insane schoolyard threats. Basically, like, I mean, just like a wacko.
It was wacky.
Yeah.
It was real wacky. And it was so funny that it was The New Yorker, which is such a like staid,
I know. Yeah, exactly.
You know,
uh-huh.
magazine. Like, it's of all that, they're not even reporters really. At the New, like, The New Yorker is a weekly. It's not The New York Times.
Yeah,
it's
right.
not The Washington Post.
Yeah.
It's not a daily newspaper.
Right.
It's like a news analysis and culture analysis,
culture. Yeah, I know.
You know,
yeah.
magazine. So, like, it's hilarious to me that he started there. But it's also hilarious to me that they ran this story
well,
after it.
Know.
And well, he doesn't know anything.
Yeah, no.
He really
doesn't
know.
Yeah.
He's a man who doesn't know.
Yeah.
And now that we know he doesn't know, nothing
As
different
As Tommy Lauren continued to tell us at Politicon, well, he's one of yours because he used to be a liberal. And like,
yeah,
where,
her comeback
where,
for this is so hilarious in schoolyard.
Right, exactly. And also, like, and Simone Sanders, who, you know, Chelsea Handler, again, was one of the moments where she didn't really necessarily
yeah,
have a comeback for this.
Fumbled the
but
question.
But like, so, I think it was Simone Sanders, right, today? But
yeah.
she was like, well, you can have him.
Yeah.
Or maybe that was Chelsea
It might have
Handler.
Been Chelsea Handler, actually.
Now I think
Somebody
it was.
Somebody said it.
Because she usually has a snappy comeback.
Yeah, a snappy
like
comeback's
that.
Not her problem.
I think that might have been Chelsea Handler.
Yeah. Yeah. In any case,
regardless, but
Tommy
like,
Lawrence.
But you can have him, is the moral of what I'm trying to say.
Ability to punt and deflect questions that are about the sort of inherent hypocrisy
different.
Of supporting Donald Trump
right, exactly.
while not supporting anything he does
right.
is
yeah.
amazing. I mean, there's a reason that she is still alive and in existence in
right.
in the public sphere.
Yeah.
I mean,
uh-huh.
I'm not surprised she's still alive. I'm surprised
yeah.
that she's still
I am
around.
Because I'm surprised Simone Sanders didn't
well,
kill
that's
her.
That's true, yeah. But, I mean, she was not, you know, we walked out of the first panel and thought, okay, she's someone who's more intelligent than we thought, who's just misled. We walked out of the second panel and thought, okay, she's a complete idiot and she'll never figure it out.
I know.
But either way, she was good at staying calm and being semi-articulate through a litany of logical arguments being thrown against her that there was no way to argue your way out of.
Right, right, exactly.
So in that sense, she is the sort of perfect surrogate for Trump.
Right. She'd be a good politician herself, I think, in that regard, because that's what
she'd be an evil politician.
Well, she would, but that's what politicians are sort of classically known for. And I feel like in that respect, like she's good.
Very talented at that.
She really is.
It was kind of amazing.
Nobody cannot answer a question better than Tommy Ward.
Yeah, so true. But in any case, so that was the hilarious Scaramucci scandal of the week.
Yeah.
But then there was also some other communication blunders from the White House.
Sure.
Most notably, Donald Trump's choice to give a wackadoo political speech at the Boy Scouts Jamboree. Yeah.
Also, going back to Scaramucci, just really quickly before we get off of that, his wife filed for divorce.
Yes. Oh, right. I forgot.
On Friday.
Yeah. So it was not a good week for Scaramucci.
But not great.
Not a good week at all.
I think maybe she's pregnant. Didn't we find out that she's pregnant today?
Yeah, there was some other element.
So, like, he's obviously, like, a real creep show, guys.
This just feels like something he did out of rage at his wife.
Yeah.
Where he was like, I'm going to fucking call the New Yorker.
Right.
And tell them what's on my mind.
Yeah.
Because the rest of my life is in literal shambles.
Yeah.
But also, I would say it's probably a good choice to divorce somebody who is a Democrat one day and then takes a job in Trump's White House.
Right, exactly.
I think that's a person who's confused, who's going through something, and you don't need to stick around for
that. Yeah, exactly. But yes, the Boy Scout speech.
Tell us about the Boy Scout speech. Brent has watched the whole thing.
I've watched the whole thing.
Obsessed with it.
I'm obsessed with it. I continue to be obsessed with it. I continue to tell everyone that they should watch it. If you can't sit through, it sort of was the moment for me. And I acknowledge that it is a dangerous moment, especially considering we are only 6 months into a presidency. And I am not proud to say this to you, but I feel like this was the speech that really put me to the point where we sort of got to with Sarah Palin last year, at Politicon, where it was sort of
your fascination outweighed your horror.
Exactly. Like the fascination with it and like to take yourself out of the politics of it, which wasn't supposed to be political at all, because he claimed at the beginning of the speech that it wasn't going to be political because it was a speech to Boy Scouts, and then it ended up being super political. But he doesn't know what he knows. Right, exactly. You know? Like taking yourself out of it, I truly believe, at least up to now in his presidency, that speech is the speech that future humans will be able to sort of throw on and be like, that is what
the worst presidency in history looks like, that is what
and also just sort of it encompasses everything about Donald Trump that has come to it had insane threats to fire Tom Price if he didn't get the healthcare votes, who was just happened to be up there. It had crazy, inappropriate stories, certainly. He said that he wasn't going to get political, and then he got, super political. He told people to, call their representatives. These are people who can't vote. I mean, it just had, it was so crazy. And the craziest part, which, if you can't sit through 50 minutes of it, you have to watch these seven minutes of it. Because he, goes on he starts talking about momentum. And then he's like, the word momentum makes me think of, and, everyone who is there at this point realizes that something insane is about to happen. Yeah. And he goes.
Everyone there is 12, by the way, but they know. Right,
but they know. And Rick Perry, who was standing behind him on stage, definitely knew.
Yeah.
And if Rick Perry knows and 12-year-olds know. Yes,
this is a man who can't remember the third thing, but he knew.
Exactly, but he knew. Yeah. And it was a story about the other thing that the speech had was which was contained in this portion of the speech, some maybe not so coded racism.
Well,
because
sure.
The speech was Trump. About the momentum of keeping, and he was trying to tell it a story that actually had a moral, which he sort of got around to, but he kind of had to back his way into it telling a story to 12-year-olds about being at a cocktail party that he was invited to because he was doing pretty well for himself. So it also had braggadocious ridiculousness in a way, but it was about William Levitt, who if you don't know who that is, look it up. But he invented Levittowns, which was sort of the first push to the suburbs, where he basically he really invented suburbs. If you can think
Levittown,
about that, post World War II, when people started to move out of the cities,
every house looks the same. It's little box. It's little houses made of ticky tacky. In the words of,
but they came. So he obviously, so Trump obviously has some hero worship for him because he's a big real estate guy and he did obviously do really well in real real estate. But what Levitan sort of like ultimately became famous for is that they
redlining.
Do. Yeah, exactly. They would not they would not allow black people to like live in the suburbs, which is sort of like on so many levels, sort of like how we have like a lot of the problems like in cities that he is also sort of like trashing himself. Like so another thing the speech had was like his inability to sort of like put two pieces of information together to like come to a point that like should like be a bullet to his head.
He was raised in the business of redlining, and this is the person who was the most successful redliner in history.
Exactly.
But so like, of course he admires
him. But like the story is about like this like, you know, this crazy, you know, party in New York City, this cocktail party that he was invited to because like he was doing really well in real estate and he recognized William Levitt, who was like sitting in the corner and who looked like really rough, and like apparently he had like after he had like got all of this money, he like bought a bunch of yachts and like went on like all of these, but he lost his momentum. Like that was the moral of the story was like that, you know, while he went and he sort of like had all this fun and he had the yachts, but then Trump also made sure to be like, but it's not so bad to have some yachts and go have some fun every once in a while either. You know, like just like crazy things.
Yeah.
Like was that like he had lost his momentum in business. So he had moved back to New York and like tried to get back into the real estate game and sort of like couldn't. So Donald Trump went over and talked to him and was like, how are you doing? And he was like, well, I'm doing really terrible. And like it was all about like momentum and just sort of like keep doing what you love and sort of like, so like the moral was sort of like a, like the actual moral alone, like separated from the story, was like fine.
Right.
Like in the sense that
age
like
appropriate.
Like keep doing what you love, like don't ever give up, like, you know, like keep the momentum, like whether it's in business or in your life, and sort of like, but just the way that he got to it with like a story about a, like a known racist, and like a, it was just like so crazy that like you really should watch it because it's like baffling.
I believe he also referred to the hero of Titan of Industry that that discovered Time Warner.
Oh, yes, I can't remember what his name is, but like yeah, he said that somebody discovered Time Warner as if it was like a thing like, that was like out in the Amazon.
Jungle. Yeah,
yeah.
They came upon the lost city of Time Warner.
I know.
The Atlantis of corporations.
Oh God! But anyway,
I feel
watch it. I like
the way that Brent speaks about the speech is the way that I spoke about the Trump Steaks press conference. I feel like in terms of on brandness and sort of encompassing everything that is the Donald Trump ethos, this is like first speech of his presidency and not his campaign.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It had that
encompasses
feel to it.
The Trump Steaks you know, ethos.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I loved the Trump Steaks press conference.
I know. Yeah.
I watched every moment of it. My parents went out for ice cream while I was watching that, and I turned down ice cream in order to watch the rest of that press conference.
Yeah.
That's very unlike me, you guys. But I just, like Brent, that was the first and only moment of the Trump administration so far where my fascination has outweighed my horror.
Yeah. Because, it's a horror show, this speech.
Oh,
I mean,
of course.
It's a total horror
of
show.
Of course. But there's, like, a moment where you're so, like, engrossed in how insane everything is that it does become the reality television that allow, you know, enough of a kind of fictionalized version of reality that you kind of disassociate from it.
Yeah.
And that's dangerous.
It's totally dangerous.
I mean, at the end
that's
of the speech,
I know,
you have to come back to reality and be
like
that
shit,
really
that's
happened.
The president.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But during the speech, you can just sort of stay engrossed in the
really,
in the present.
Just be in it.
Just be in it.
Let it take over.
Let it wash over you.
God. He gave another one of those speeches.
Sure
oddly
did.
Enough. He's really had a great speech.
You know what the police
week.
Haven't been doing enough, Brent?
Yeah, banging
roughing
people's
up
head
their
on the hoods of their police cars. That's what.
Gave a speech to a bunch of police about how they should be roughing people up more. Most, not most, I won't say, because there's a big issue with police, you know, aggressive police in this country, but a lot of police forces have denounced this message because
which is good. Great.
Well, one of the things that I think a lot of, especially in urban areas and not in enough urban areas, but in a lot of sort of more progressive police forces is we've been trying to talk about de-escalation and how we can train police to sort of exist in a world where everyone has fucking guns in this country. And we get that it's a dangerous job because of that, but in a way where they can de-escalate situations in a way where racially based violence doesn't become the norm for them, you know, in a way that we can sort of have a substantive discussion about the role of the police in especially cities, but everywhere, so that they can do the job of protecting us and not do the job of killing black and brown people in startling numbers.
Right.
Donald Trump doesn't think, apparently, that we're doing enough roughing people up, though.
Nope. Not enough.
This is crazy because this kind of statement makes things so much more dangerous for the police. And it also kind of, like, it it divert in the way that like going to war can divert the conversation away from taking care of veterans and towards some sort of weird movement to support. This diverts the conversation away from how we keep police safe and diverts it towards how we make society dangerous.
Right.
You know,
yeah, for sure.
Like, and it gives, you know, it gives sort of bad apple cops the license to be like, well, my job is to, you know, is to rough everyone up. But it also, it doesn't make the job safer or easier for police when people expect this kind of action from them. It doesn't make it possible for them to de-escalate situations the way that we are hopefully going to train them to do at some point.
Yeah.
It's just like, it's one of those things where it defeats the sort of long-term goal in an effort to gain political capital, but it doesn't do anything for society.
Yeah.
Because even if you are in the police force, and listen, one of, you know, I lobby with a lot of first responders for the 9/11 health bill. I've spent time with a lot of people who have spent their careers in the police force, and I'm often shocked by how differently they see the world than I do. For them, there are threats around every corner. There is a lot of inherent racism in the way that they see the world because they spent all of these time in community, these times in communities of color where they were unwelcome because they were making things more dangerous.
Right, exactly.
Where then in turn, they saw people of color committing crimes and that, you know, like it kind of fucked them up. And so I get that there's a lot of work to do in that regard.
Totally.
But this, you know, this kind of rhetoric doesn't make it any safer for them to go into any communities of color or not and like do their job.
Right. I was going to say if they, I mean, like certainly it's more, it's probably not more terrifying for black people because this is a thing that they have been dealing with for literally like hundreds of years.
Well, I mean, it seems to be terrifying for everybody.
Well, terrifying for everybody. But you're right. What I don't think that he is thinking about, because he obviously doesn't care about whether black people are getting roughed up or not. Right. Like that's not a thing that he's caring about, but like,
well, our cities are burning, Brent. What are they supposed to do?
I know exactly. But like, you're absolutely right. What I don't think that he is thinking about is that like, if a police officer goes into, you know, a neighborhood who thinks
that officer is there to kill them.
That officer is there to kill. Like
that's going to make everyone else react in a crazy manner.
Like it just turns the whole thing into
And that's something, you know, we heard a lot about that at Politicon on the at the Black Lives Matter panel where they were kind of talking about how in a community where the police are not trusted, you know, the police's presence generates other crimes. Like the fact that the police are there generates a higher crime rate. When the police pull back, the crime rate pulls back.
Yeah.
And that's a concerning statistic that should be the case.
Yeah, well, and that's what I have, you know, I mean, like, it has been going on for a really long time, but we were actually just talking about this on the way home, but, like, I saw the movie Detroit on Friday night, which I would recommend everybody going to see.
It was so disturbing that Brent couldn't finish his Raisinets.
If they have the stomach for it. Like, don't go if you don't have the stomach for it. But, I mean, like, that is also, like, I mean, it's about the Detroit riots in the 60s, but it's sort of also about a specific moment of police brutality that took place in the Algiers Hotel, where three people, young kids, were killed by police. But, like, what was interesting about it, because I didn't really know much about like the specific story or also the Detroit riots at all, but like they happened because of the almost all white Detroit police force that was basically patrolling all of the areas of Detroit that were almost all black because everybody had left the city of Detroit basically like by that point to like to move to probably some Levittowns honestly because like white people were moving out of the suburbs post World War II.
Detroit is ringed by white suburbs
so and that is what ultimately caused those riots was the was the white police force like just basically like brutalizing and not even brutalizing but literally just like being there and people don't, it should be easy to get, and like their lack of getting that is like sort of unfathomable, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't get it.
I think that it is difficult when you are a person who has always felt protected by the police to imagine a world where that's not everyone's experience. Right. And I think that's especially true if you are a white man, because you have never even been intimidated physically by the police 100%. In the way that women, even white women sometimes are. But even if, like, if someone, you know, if I am in some sort of situation where I truly need help, I don't have to hesitate to call the police.
No.
I know they will come and help me.
Right.
And that is not the case in a lot of communities. And that is, and now the more that I kind of learn about it, the more that I even have to think, like, who, like, if I call the police now for myself, is there someone whose life will be ruined by that, who doesn't deserve it, who's not me? You know, like, now that even my dawning awareness, because in my experience, the police have always been there to help me, you know, and it maybe with the exception of my protesting days. That's been my only negative experience with the police. And that certainly has colored my impression of when I do think that they are there to protect me and when I don't, you know. But I think now, like, even for myself, like, I, when I think about the police, because of, you know, partially because of movements like Black Lives Matter, partially because of this discussion about around police brutality in general, partially because I know that there's an idiot running the country going around telling police to rough everyone up, I have to think to myself, like, okay, if I call the police now for myself, I know that they'll probably come to my rescue, but whose life is going to be ruined in this process? I'm not interested in retribution and that kind of justice.
Also,
I'm interested in keeping myself safe, but that's it.
Right. And as we learned at the Black Lives Matter panel, the LAPD is the
highest murder rate in the country.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, so that's something, especially in LA, to think about.
Yeah.
But that this kind of message makes you even... If you are a person who's connected to communities of color, you now have to think about this even when you want to call the police for yourself.
Yeah,
but if you are a person who doesn't have connections to communities of color, as, you know, many white people are, then it's probably difficult to wrap your mind around a world in which the police is not there to protect you. And I just, like, don't know how you reach those people.
Yeah, I don't either.
I think the discussion, at least, is happening.
Yes.
In other places.
Right.
But it's...
Need more people to listen.
But I mean, it's gonna wind its way backwards if Trump is walking around telling people that the police, they should beat everyone up.
Totally.
By the way, it's not good if the police are beating anyone up. Because what if you're a punk teenager who's white and you just happen to get wrapped up in a bunch of nonsense and then the police have license to beat people up?
Yeah.
And so you're suddenly one of the people that gets beaten up. Like, that doesn't benefit anyone.
Sure doesn't.
You know, there's no world in which your life is better because the police are roughing up, you know, black and brown people or teenagers or young people or whatever it is. There's no world in which your life is better for that.
Nope.
And there's not even a world in which the police's lives are better than that. Because that
means you get off on that,
situations
which some people might.
Escalate that didn't need to escalate.
Yeah.
In any case, we will be back at some point with a Politicon supercut, as I've been calling it. And we will also be probably doing a few bi-coastal podcasts and some other, because we're both going to be doing a little traveling in the next month or so. But
Week might be a little difficult. But
might be dicey. But we will be here when we're here. It's August, too, so, like...
Yeah, right?
Whatever. What's the news? It's just going to be more gossip. And, well, if it's too exciting, then we'll report on it.
Yeah.
Because that's the kind of people we are.
Yeah.
But we will talk to you, if not next week, the week after.
Yeah.
And we will have a cut for you of our time at Politicon, which you should listen to because it was really
fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Politicon is always fun, and it's the only time of year that you get to be, that I get to be, in a truly bipartisan situation where, for the most part, I feel safe. For the most part, I feel able to be a rowdy crowd member without, you know, worrying about other people being a rowdy crowd member. And maybe in the longer Trump America goes on, that'll change. But because of that, it offers, I think, some interesting insights for us into how to understand what's going on right now.
Totally.
Yeah. And also, we want to be best friends with Simone Sanders. So if you know her, tell her that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Bye.
That's the news. Bye.